All right. I was a student here many years ago, and I was on the college radio station. And since 95.9 FM radio is recording, I figured I could do a plug like that. So tonight is a program of extreme history. If you don't know who Hazel Hunkins is, you're not alone. In the Billings area, not many people know her. It was only about 6 years ago that we were looking through the Library of Congress records of photographs, and photo number 249 was a picture of a young woman with a sash that read, Hazel Hunkins of Billings, Montana, suffragist. So the first thing I did is went over to the Women's History Museum in downtown Billings, and I said, what do you know about this Hazel Hunkins, this suffragist? And ironically, and you'll see the irony later, they had a picture of Alice Paul, who was the leader of the National Women's Party, on their wall, but they had actually never heard of Hazel Hunkins. And I think you'll have more questions at the end of this program after you hear a little bit about her story. I'm going to focus primarily on she's almost got three stories for one person's lifetime, and I'm going to focus on the first part of that story, which is when she first got involved with the National Women's Party and also her work during World War I protesting in front of the White House. So Hazel Hunkins was born in Colorado but moved to Billings, Montana in 1903. Her family operated Hunkins Jewelry Store on North Broadway, which you can see here. It's part of the Babcock block. It would be where Jimmy John's restaurant is today. And her family became prominent in town because of the jewelry store. Her father first operated the business, and then her stepbrother took it over. She was the top of her class at Billings High School in 1908. She was voted as the most popular, the second brightest, and the third most conceited. And this is incredible about her story. The first year in 1908 was the first year the Billings High School produced a yearbook. We have a three-page speech from Hazel Hunkins as a 16-year-old thinking about the world ahead of her. And you'll be so blown away by her story. But and interesting, and I'm going to contrast it with her as the top of the class and then this person who was second with the class. So here's Hazel, obviously, on the right. Ray Van Houten is in the middle of those two guys. So Hazel basically wrote in her memories about how grateful she was and how thankful she was for her fellow teachers and for her students. And she wrote, and should time separate us by the prairies and mountains of the Great West, by the forests of the East, or even of the deep rolling waves of the sea, the loving memory of happy days and joys shared together in Billings High School will never be forgotten. Farewell, my classmates, farewell. I wanted to contrast with another perception that was at the time, and I think this is what's staggering to me, is the odds that she had to overcome to be a protest person at the time period. So Ray Van Houten, who was second class, writes this in his three-page speech. Excessive immigration is an imminent danger to our citizenship. Many Japanese, Italians, Greeks, Russians, and Poles who are too ignorant and shiftless to rise in their own land come here to the USA. And this immigration evil is one of the biggest feeders to the wrong type of citizenship. Ray says, let us bring back the standard of American citizenship back to the standard of our Puritan forefathers. And that was in 1908. So she graduated at the top of her class, but I don't know if this says something about Billings High. She did still have to go for a year of prep school before she actually went off to college. She went to Vassar College and got a degree in chemistry, came back, and she started teaching at University of Missouri. The photos that you see, all of her collections are at the Schlesinger Library at Harvard University. So myself and also Ruth Ferris have spent time there and gone through her private collections, all her photographs, her diaries. She also has another large collection of her experiences at the I think it's the London School of Economics in London, England, too. So Tim Lehman, actually, the professor from Rocky, went to London to get some of those records. A little context for the time period. So as Hazel's teaching chemistry at the University of Missouri, they're setting up on the streets of Butte to have a clash over women getting the right to vote here in the state of Montana. Jeanette Rankin and her forces would be on one side of the street, and on the other is the women opposed to suffrage. And we have all these pamphlets in our collections. They're just amazing. And, you know, one of the basic premises is, you know, I married my husband for a reason. There's no reason I should vote. And you could see this cartoon, you know, this woman who's a suffragist. Obviously, she's not taking care of the house. So you see a lot of that in that battle. Of course, in 1914, women get the right to vote. And quickly, the eldest daughter of a rancher and a school teacher, Jeanette Rankin, is voted as the first congresswoman in the United States history. She was also involved with the women's suffrage movement prior to Hazel Hunkins getting involved. But by, like I said, 1914, all of the Western states had already brought in suffrage for women. And that was one of the debates. There were so many different strategies at the time period to figure out how to get this through. Some groups believed that it was a states' rights issue. President Woodrow Wilson thought it was a states' rights issue, and that slowly but surely would chip across the United States. So these are the states by 1914 that had given women the right to vote. Again, there's all of these different strategies. Her strategy will be frowned upon as she gets further into the movement. People like Roosevelt, Hearst, Whitney, Guggenheim, Roosevelt, Vanderbilt, Pinchot, and Ballard supported the 1916 candidate for president, Charles Evans Hughes, because Hughes was going to make it a national amendment. People like Frances Willard and Carrie Nation, leaders of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, supported suffrage, but also focused on the prohibition of alcohol. Margaret Sanger, at the time, the American birth control activist and advocate for women's reproductive rights, popularized the term birth control, supported women's reproductive rights at the same time focusing on suffrage. So you have all of these different women, Ida Wells, people like Carrie Chapman, Catt, they all have different strategies. Carrie Chapman Catt, who was the founder of the League of Women Voters, believed it was a state's right thing. We could chip away and maybe a national amendment would come about. So that gives you a little context. Hazel Hunkins comes back to Billings when her mother is ailing. And she comes back to take care of her mom. She actually gets some work at the Billings High School. So this is her in 1916. She applies for some jobs, some chemistry jobs at local labs in Billings. For example, we know the sugar factory was one place she applied. And basically she was told that you are qualified for the job, but we really don't want a woman working in our lab. So at the same time this is happening to her and she's getting these odd messages conveyed to her, a woman by the name of Clara Louise Rowe is traveling through Montana speaking on behalf of what would become the National Women's Party. And Hazel was completely swept up in the movement at that point. Hazel also noted, while her other childhood girlfriends were getting married to the local boys, she said, quote unquote, "I looked at my girlfriend's domesticity with great disdain." The National Women's Party, the two probably most pivotal figures are Alice Paul and Lucy Burns. They both knew each other. They were Americans who had gone to England, had fought on behalf of the Women's Social and Political Union, which was the suffrage movement in England. They had a rather radical approach. They were both, Alice Paul, I think, was arrested 6 times and imprisoned 3 times in England. Comes back to the United States in 1910 using some of the strategies that she had learned in England to try to make a point. One of the things that she did, she went on a hunger strike when she was in England that gave her health issues for the rest of her life because they would force feed political prisoners who refused to eat. And so she had some health issues from basically 1908 on through the rest of her life. So these two women would be pivotal in terms of Hazel Hunkins' future. So as I said, Hazel Hunkins immediately joins the movement. In 1916, she went to Colorado Springs, Colorado. She said, "We were there to launch the campaign of the National Women's Party. We were out on the street corners, all open air, and I was standing by Alice Paul. Alice Paul turned to me and said, 'Go on, say something.' I looked at her. She had such blue eyes. They were so dark, they were almost purple. One didn't disobey Alice Paul. She was such a compelling person. I got on the back of a truck, and I have no idea what I said, but later she told me I was wonderful. And that's August of 1916, so only a couple weeks after she hears this talk by Clara Louise Rowe in Montana. She's already in Colorado Springs. Another month goes by, and she's stumping in the back of cars and automobiles, learning the trade of how to speak in public. She flies in an airplane in the San Francisco region to drop pamphlets over. So they become, they want to get a lot of publicity for their work. And as a matter of fact, you can see the little note. She says, "My first ride in an airplane with Silas Christopherson, a stunt pilot, you know, this is kind of a daring thing to do, a young woman getting in a plane. Christopherson died a month later in a plane accident. So, and he was considered one of the best aviators at the time. So again, as we go into the fall of 1916 and into the winter, Hazel Hunkins and Bessie Paprandre smuggled a large banner in their purse and unfurled it from the upper gallery during President Wilson's address to Congress. It read, "Mr. President, what will you do for women's suffrage?" The flag was taken away by a page. No one was arrested, and the other suffragists there congratulated them for their cunning. So I love that. So, and I love the women outwit the guards and pages, you know. So again, they're getting good press at this point. They're being supportive, even though they're doing stuff that, you know, the president addressing Congress and they're dropping this big banner from the balcony on the second floor. But where they really start stirring up trouble is, what a lot of people consider the first protest movement in front of the White House, beginning in January of 1917. On January 10, 1917, Alice Paul led a dozen women to the gates of the White House. The first people ever to picket the White House, they called themselves the Silent Sentinels. And Hazel is in the circle there with the University of Missouri sash. And they would do this for months. They would do this for years. They would protest in front of the White House. And you'll see how the big shift happens when the war starts in a second here. So, you know, one of the questions I have is, how does no one in Billings in Montana know her story? And I think it has something to do with access to the press. Right now, we have access on the internet to all the papers in the country. The Billings Gazette did not talk about Hazel Hunkins. She was an embarrassment to her family. But this, as you can see, these headlines, these are front page articles from the Washington Post, the San Francisco Examiner, the Oakland Tribune. Hazel Hunkins is getting actually more press at this time than Alice Paul, who's the leader of the organization. One paper said, "Hazel Hunkins, pretty and 23 of Billings, Montana, is qualified for membership in the old guard if endurance against icy blasts, her ability to carry a suffrage banner, or the strength of her earnest conviction on suffrage count for everything." This is the photo that actually I first found years ago that's at the Library of Congress. And again, Washington Post, the women who are guarding the White House portals. So they carried these banners in front of the White House throughout the winter of 1917. And again, you know, you can see Hazel Hunkins is listed as one of the group of seven that are out there. And again, a lot of the famous names of the suffrage movement, Mabel Vernon, Alice Paul, Lucy Burns, are all standing side by side with her. Now the war is getting close. President Wilson wins a second term, and on March 4th of 1917, Hazel Hunkins of Montana leads a group of protesters in front of the White House during President Wilson's second inauguration parade. She was identified as the standard bearer for all states where both men and women can now vote. So she was representing the Western United States as she carried her banner. And you can see them along the parade route, protesting, about three dozen women or so. So the focus is really about the war. What happens? What changes when the war starts? And I love this photo, you know, because these women for the National Women's Party become incredibly isolated. And this is a picture of one of those women. It could be actually Hazel Hunkins to her left. You know, with protesters around them, people screaming at them, people spitting at them, people throwing eggs at them. And you get a sense of that with this woman in this particular photo from the Library of Congress. And, you know, the press was unfair in some ways to, they wanted to build up the momentum of patriotism. And so this is actually a critique of Jeanette Rankin. You know, Rankin, of course, voted against the war. She wasn't the only woman who voted against it. But because she was a woman, she took on a responsibility that this Billings Gazette editorial said the day after the war started. She said, Rankin ran true to the feminine form when she voted against the war resolution and lost the most brilliant opportunity that has been offered to any woman in modern times. It is the hardest blow that has been struck at suffrage, because the very people who argued against it have had them proven to them that women in critical movements do not think straight and act only under emotion and sentiment. So even there's this instance where Jeanette Rankin stood her ground and said, you know, along with many men, congressmen, that she would not support the war. But the Billings Gazette comes out and uses it in a sense against her as a woman. So, and then locally here in Billings, we're not in Billings, are we? Editorials of the Billings Gazette continue. One says, the duty of the patriot. Among the foes of the United States who live among us in Billings might be mentioned German sympathizers, pacifists, financial slackers, opponents of the draft, and numerous others who are not giving every energy, every thought, every endeavor to the greatest and purest cause that has ever existed, the defeat of Germany. Another editorial said, the pacifists of Billings, they spread a propaganda second only in viciousness to that of the actual pro-Germans. Pacifism is a state of mind without any thought. And then the sheriff's proclamation right here, it ends by saying, every citizen owns undivided allegiance to the American flag. Any act, however slight, tending to give aid or comfort to the enemy is treason. So all of these things to me set up what they were facing in terms of their opposition. Because, you know, if they were going to continue to protest during the war, everything is saying that if you do anything besides support the war's effort, you're not a patriot. And so you'll see what happens very quickly to them. Even the suffragists, people like Carrie Chapman Catt, basically called out the suffragists, the National Women's Party, and said, you need to stop protesting. Now is not the time to be in front of the White House protesting. So suffragists started coming out in opposition to their own pickets. She wanted to remove the suffrage pickets from the White House. She made a controversial decision to support only the war effort, which shifted the public's perception in favor of the suffragists, who were now perceived as patriotic. And again, people like the National Women's Party and Hazel Hunkins were seen as the antithesis of patriotism. So right after the war starts in April of 1917, the press becomes really angry, it seems, against this movement. And so here's one story from June of 1917. Women led mob attacking the pickets. A group of women, including suffragists, attacked the women as they were protesting in front of the White House. Hazel Hunkins actually climbed up the White House gate to try to hold her banner, and it was taken out of her hand, and her pole was broken in half. Almost another protest brought 2,000 protesters surrounding these three dozen women, basically, you know, saying, what are you doing? They yelled, traitor, treason, and they charged the protesters and destroyed all their banners. Hazel Hunkins, one of the most persistent servitors, was arrested when she arrived with a new banner the next day. Okay, a couple more pieces about how they were being covered in the press. One woman on the streets while watching the protesters in front of the White House said, it is shocking to think that such thin-blooded, narrow-minded women should have ever been born. These women are living in the best country in the world, enjoying all the wonderful privileges and freedom a republic offers, and they don't even seem to know it. They are vicious, contemptible in the sight of God and man, pig-headed, brainless, and heartless. So with the protests continuing on, even with all this public pressure to leave it, there's all these great proposals to literally, unquote, unquote, clean the sidewalks. They were complaining that these three or four dozen women that were protesting were taking up too much space and that the Capitol Police would start crack down on the protesters. Now, initially, they had been already arrested a couple times at this point, but this idea was the Capitol Police would arrest them to help almost save them. You know what I mean? To secure that they wouldn't be hurt by all these other protesters coming in. But Representative Howard of Georgia introduced a bill designed to prevent the suffragists from displaying any of their banners in the vicinity of the White House or any other public building. They still continue to protest, and they still continue to be arrested. So this is Hazel Hunkins again standing in front of the White House. And all of these articles have her in it. Again, it's perplexing to me that Montanans don't know her story when anybody at the time would have seen Hazel Hunkins of Billings, you know. In the state of Montana, she was not well received. The Helena Independent, which was run by a gentleman named Campbell, who is also a leader of the Sedition Act in Billings, or in Montana. The Helena Independent says they don't agree with Mrs. Richardson. Richardson was actually a suffragist, that Hazel Hunkins of Montana is a dirty yellow traitor. Hazel is simply, this is from the paper, Hazel is simply one of the misguided friends of the suffrage cause. She is part of the lunatic fringe, which hangs around forever around the edge of the suffrage cause. Little Miss Hazel Hunkins of Montana has been misled. If the duty of Congressman Jeanette Rankin, it's the duty of Rankin to hunt up this little Vassar graduate and pin a tag to her so she will not get lost on her long journey and then send her back to Montana. If Hazel is naughty when she gets out here in the sunshine, where straight thinking is the rule in Montana, her mother should take her out behind the woodshed and let the neighbors hear the gentle patter of her slipper on the bustle of Hazel's overalls. So that's pretty hostile, wouldn't you say? This is in July of 1917. The Women's Club of Billings, this is from the Butte Miner. The Women's Club of Billings stated that it did not approve of the displays of banners and of this, in front of the White House, and that it was in no sense the sentiment of this community, especially in time of war. A Billings girl was one of the star performers in parading the banners. This should not be construed as an expressive of sentiment in Billings on the subject of women's suffrage. These sentiments expressed on the banners are improper at a time when the war is going on. So the amazing part of this story is we have all her diaries, all her letters, firsthand accounts of what her experience was. And so we have all these letters to her mother and basically what an embarrassment she was to her family. She's explaining to her mother in one of these letters what happened at the protest when the 2,000 anti-protesters came up, or the protesters came up. She said, Mrs. Richardson, the suffragist, came up to me and said, I ought to be ashamed of myself to stand there and hold a banner that she said read, we demand democracy and self-government in our own land. She came back and took a hold of my banner and spit on it, and my heart sank. It was the first time I had seen such venom, and I could hardly only meet it by absolutely ignoring it and saying nothing. That is the habit I've learned. When in doubt, do nothing. Passive resistance. One minute I was standing there in perfect peace and quiet, holding a banner. 3 minutes later I was holding a broken staff with no banner in the center of a surging crowd. Well, anyway, it was, quote unquote, she says, an experience. An experience I never want to go through again and hate to read any accounts of it. This is more letters from her mother, and I love this quote. She's writing her mother, and she said, a man came down to the picket line the other day and said to me, I brought my little boy especially to see you girls. I wanted him to see history in the making. And then she says further, I have watched public opinion change in such a short time that I wouldn't be surprised to be greeted as a hero rather than as an offender sooner or later. She says to her mother, I'm not sorry for a thing I've done. We've been attacked in the press, and every minute has been darkened by the thought of what you were suffering in Billings. I know you hate publicity, Mother, and I also know how little you know of the dirty games that go on. The news is twisted and contorted to suit the policy of the views of the editor. You must take the attitude that more than half you read is false, and the other half is contaminated with the writer's own viewpoint. She says, Mother, I can imagine you walking downtown or walking uptown in Billings and feeling that every eye is on you as the mother of a notorious character. If friends ask you about it, I would treat it as a good joke that you didn't relish that anything, or you didn't relish anything that serious. So, and again, she says, you know, watching public opinion, she felt like they were on the right side of history and that eventually their work would be received well. So the question about what was covered in the Billings Gazette, very little. You know, again, you can get all these national papers, read all of this stuff, but here's the Billings Gazette, page 7, July 20, 1917, page 7, halfway down there, you can see right kind of where the arrow is. It says, Billings girl innocent victim. So that's what the Gazette covered it as. And then the article goes on and says, when asked why she and other suffragists were making laughing stocks of themselves, Miss Hunkins said, we are taking advantage of the war situation to point out that if this war is for democracy, if we are to send our soldiers 3,000 miles into the trenches of a foreign land to fight for democracy, it would not be amiss to have democracy extended at home. Asked if the picketing will go on, Hazel Hunkin said, yes, even though it means arrest, we will go on picketing because we know we are within our legal rights. And then I think this is almost like a side comment. In addition, when our women, she said, were in jail, nearly all of them employed their time in knitting and making articles for the Red Cross and for the soldiers. So again, going back to this time period, you know, you see this anti-immigration stuff, you see this anti-German sentiment during the war, you see this rising fever of patriotism. This happened in Billings. The city council member was removed from the city council. A gentleman who, by the way, had been the Grand Marshal of the 1914 Billings Independence Day Parade, Curtis C. Omi, was removed from the State Board of Architecture because they didn't think he was pro-American. And yet 3 years before, he was the Grand Marshal of the July 4th Parade in Billings. As I said, the Kurtzeborn and Schwans, they were all basically humiliated. They had to walk around the streets of Billings kissing an American flag to show their true patriotism. And this is part of the Sedition Act, which really does kind of rise out of the Billings area. So on the same day, I love this, Hunkin's Jewelry has two ads in the newspaper, very pro-patriotic. Do you know what I mean? Again, their daughter is an embarrassment to them. She's protesting during the war, but Hunkin's Jewelry is saying, you know, support the soldiers, buy liberty bonds down here. So the family locally is making this kind of, trying to find a balancing act. And again, the Gazette isn't really covering a lot of what's really going on. This is actually, this is from the Billings Evening Journal. Hazel Hunkins arouses ire of workers. Apparently, she went to speak at a Red Cross meeting up at Helena, and a whole bunch of people left. This is what the paper reports. She actually wrote that she had a great time, and the people were really nice. So I'm not quite sure. You know, the paper has this kind of inflammatory headline about Hazel Hunkins coming and people leaving and, you know, in droves. But Hazel Hunkins, in her own record, actually has a very different experience. So I'm not sure what's real or not. Again, we have all these wonderful letters of her experience from behind the scenes. So I'll just read you a short little paragraph. She said, my summer vacations from 1916 to 1920 were spent with my mother and half-brother in Billings. When I settled into the company of the young men and women with whom I had grown up, there appeared a gulf between us. Each summer, it became more apparent. I complained to my mother, I just can't get interested in Jimmy, the manager of the telephone company, as he can't talk about anything but love and business, or the owner of the milling company, no matter how rich he is. And Jack, a friend, said, everyone who didn't believe in the war was just plain yellow. And my first childhood love, whom I shall remember with affection, thought of his father's real estate business, weekdays, and fishing on the weekends. In a way, I love them all, but as for marrying any of them, I would rather go to prison. You can see right at the bottom there. And she does several times. So this is a famous event in the women's rights movement. What leads to what's called the Night of Terror on November 15, 1917. Suffragists are charged and then jailed at the Occoquan prison in Virginia, which, you know, had really shabby conditions. Hazel was with this first group that was part of this jail mutiny. They actually had like fights with like prison guards and the other prisoners, African-American prisoners. They had this big fight. They were released. They were arrested again because they kept going back and protesting. They said, well, we'll let you go. Don't protest anymore. And then they'd go right back out on the streets and start putting their banners out. And late in October of 1917, several, again, they're all arrested, including Alice Paul. Now, Alice Paul had learned from her work in England how to make noise. And one of the ways to do it was to really make a stand. And what she did, Alice Paul, while she was in Occoquan, was basically starving herself, went on a hunger strike along with Rose Winslow. So another group, though, so for weeks, the women's only water came from an open pail. Their food, all of it, a colorless slop, was infested with worms. The blankets, I don't know how they would know this, were washed only once a year. Rose Winslow and Alice Paul began a hunger strike, and within several days, they had to start force feeding her again, which is actually the same thing that had happened to her in England. And then another group was arrested on November 14, including Lucy Burns, and they actually started a hunger strike to protest the fact that they weren't being treated as political prisoners. They were being treated as criminals. On November 15, 1917, a night in the women's movement, now known as the Night of Terror, exposed the terrible treatment these political activists were receiving. Prison guards threw the women around to frighten them. They handcuffed Lucy Burns and fastened her hands above her head to a cell door, so some of them were hurt in the process. But also, public opinion began to start swaying. And that was really Alice Paul's strategy. Alice Paul felt if you could expose these types of treatments to political prisoners that eventually the press might start turning around. And that was kind of her strategy. And, you know, obviously this hunger strike is a very radical approach. So, a week before Congress reconvened in December of 1917, all of the imprisoned women, including Alice Paul, who had been sentenced for 6 months, were all released. I'm going to move right into 1918. Again, this process continues for years. So this is Hazel Hunkins at the forefront with the American flag holding a procession as they make their way to the White House again. And they just continue to defy, the calling to stop this. They keep getting arrested time and time again. And this is interesting to me. This is from the Harrisburg paper, talking about one of their arrests. But on the same page as the arrest of these suffragists is the list of all the soldiers being killed. And I'm sure that's done purposely, you know what I mean? Because, again, they're contrasting these women, you know, who keep getting arrested in front of the White House for protesting. And then at the same time, you're kind of putting all these prisoners, soldiers who had been killed in action. So public sentiment is not supportive at this point. So this is another story where she and others were first physically hurt. Hazel came out of the struggle with a sprained wrist, 37 suffs taken and retaken. Again, they would be arrested, they would be jailed, and then they would get out. And Hazel said, it is absurd to say that I obstructed the public highway or any portion. The sidewalk proper at the place charged is about 25 feet in width. And she said she took up basically about 1 square foot. So they said the suffragists were blocking the public way. And that was one of the reasons they arrested them. But like I love, because she's always noted as being slender and thin in all of these articles. I don't know why they do that. But obviously she just figured I only took up 1 square foot and it was 25 feet. So what's the problem here? In August of 1918, while burning the speeches of President Wilson, a watch fire was started at Lafayette Park near the White House by Hazel Hunkins. And this is a quote, "Our group was militant, But we never sanctioned violence. It was abhorrent to Alice Paul. Ours was a peaceful picketing, although violence was put upon us. We were clubbed by the police, had our clothing torn, had our banners ripped from the poles. I remember when I was speaking in Lafayette Square being pelted with eggs and my coat was dripping by the time I finished. There's a great story of her. Like at night, she got a cord of wood and like snuck it in the middle of the night and was putting it in the bushes so they could have their watch fire going all the time. I mean, soaked in oil, and it was a real mess. They would take the speeches of President Wilson, who was saying that's a states' rights issue, and kept burning them. So at one point this is where she would have been in prison for many years. She hopped the White House's fence and built a little watch fire below the president's window at the White House. That wouldn't go over well today, I don't think, would it? And her telegrams to her mother in 1918 take a little different tone. She said, 26 of America's finest women are accompanying to me to jail. It's splendid. Don't worry. Love, Hazel. So. And again, there's just snapshots of kind of pieces of this story. So in 1918, in September, she was accused of cursing out the American flag, which she denied. But again, it became part of the national press. This Hazel Hunkins is causing trouble again. And the Helena paper picks it up. And one of my favorite editorials, a very zealous war supporter, Will Campbell, he said, if the height of bliss lies in getting newspaper advertising, Hazel Hunkadora Hunkins of Billings ought to be satisfied. Of course, old-fashioned mothers and women generally who are fighting to win the war may not like what Hazel is alleged to have said in order to obtain publicity, but that is beside the point. The point is that Hazel Hunkins has landed her pretty Tootsie Wootsies slap in the middle of every daily newspaper in the United States. And I think even in this piece right here, it talks about Alice Paul are probably turning pea green. Hazel has accomplished something in less than 2 years, which it takes a lifetime of most women to accomplish. She has broken into all avenues of publicity. So, and the protests continue. Even though now the president is moving toward a suffrage amendment in 1919, the women aren't satisfied. They're not going to give up protesting. So in early January of 1919 now, they're in their third year, the women begin another series of watchfire demonstrations, the bronze urn at Lafayette Park. Hazel Hunkins, clinging to a high pedestaled urn, was holding aloft the suffrage tricolor. The flames played out over the slender, I don't even know what this means, Tanagra-like figure of the girl, and glowed through the purple, white, and gold. People said it was that instant's picture. Policemen immediately rushed over there, followed by a large crowd. They arrested Alice Paul, Julia Emery, Hazel Hunkins, and Edith Ainge. In the meantime, the fire in the front house, in front of the White House, had been rebuilt and rekindled by the others. So, and here she is also pictured on the militant wing of the federal suffrage amendment. And this is about the time that the Senate would pass the federal suffrage amendment, on June 4th, 1919, and then begins a 14-month basically struggle for ratification to find 3/4 of the states to ratify the amendment. On August 18, 1920, Tennessee becomes the 36th state to ratify the amendment. The 19th Amendment states simply, the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. It became part of the U.S. Constitution 8 days later. This is like a side note. This was drives me crazy. So this was ratified by 3/4 of the states. Other states waited a little while to ratify the amendment, even though it was a national amendment. Georgia ratified it in 1970. Louisiana, 1970, North Carolina, 1971, and Mississippi in 1984. So almost 64 years later. And you know, I love these images, you know, at last, these great images, you know, Alice Paul celebrating. And then, you know, basically the National Women's Party, because it had such a singular focus on just getting the right to vote on a national amendment, basically that's the end of their story at this point. You know, they had accomplished that singular focus that they wanted, where all these other groups, you know, Planned Parenthood would come out of, you know, the League of Women Voters, all these other women would rise up and have these other organizations. The National Women's Party was a singular focus, and Hazel Hunkins and her group obviously accomplished what they had to. So Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton drafted the original text for the amendment in 1878. 42 years later, the amendment passed its final hurdle of obtaining the agreement of 3/4 of the states. The organizer of the National Women's Party, which focused exclusively on getting the National Amendment, had, as one paper said, worked hard in order to work themselves out of jobs. Hazel and her future husband, Charles Hallinan, a journalist, would live and raise a family in England for the next 50 years. She would continue to work as a journalist, often using her maiden name. She would become Hazel Hunkins Hallinan only because her kids started complaining about it. They had 4 children. They're like, come on, Mom, you know. She would become the leader of the 6-point group, and I just have 2 slides left here. This is a picture from her in 1969. She became the president of the 6-point group, one of the leading feminist organizations in England. And she was the only American-born president of the 6-point group. And that's why her records for 50 years of her activism in England are all in London at the College of Economics there. And then she returns to the United States just for one more gusto in 1977 for the Equal Rights Amendment. A tiny spirited symbol of the women's movement. More than a half a century ago, it was Hazel Hunkins Hallinan who set a fire on the White House lawn in the battle for women's suffrage. She's quoted in 1977 as saying, "You could do the same thing today," said the 87-year-old fighter for equal rights, advise a new generation of feminists. And this was in the Salt Lake Tribune. And then, of course, I love the Hazel Hunkins, 87, is a tiny gray-haired woman with a feminist vocabulary and a notorious arrest record and a surprisingly sharp tongue. She got to sign a Women's Day promotion with President Carter. She got to march, and it was really sweet. She actually marches in a big parade, and she's quite elderly, and she did the march, the whole march, and she just said, "I just got so excited. I just kept marching." So there's wonderful photos of her at age 87 leading the kind of the feminists of the 1970s for the Equal Rights Amendment. Couple slides here. So in 1977, Hazel Hunkins wrote her dear friend Helene O'Donnell from Billings, her friend from Billings High School back in 1908, and she wrote her friend. She said, "I will always be grateful, Helene, for your kindnesses when I came to Billings to rebury my mother's ashes and those of my husband." My husband, Charles, had no connection with Billings, but a long time before his death, I asked him where he wanted to be buried, and he answered without a moment's delay, "I want to be wherever you are." And long before that, I had decided I wanted to live in the forever in Billings, Montana. So someday you and I will be somewhere near together in that forever land. And so she is buried at Mount View Cemetery. Now, a little sidebar here. Her husband, Charles, not a philanthropist, a philanderer. Is that the term? Yes, philanderer. Very different, isn't it? Like, for example, she was doing some work for the State Department in D.C., and she went back home, and her husband was living with a woman, and the woman's underwear were, like, in the bedroom, and he was trying to claim it was a friend. So they had some troubles in their relationships over the years, but and here's the beauty of it. You can see Hazel, my daughter, standing by Hazel's grave. Charles's grave is actually at her feet, because he died first. And if you can see what it says on her grave, Charles Thomas Hallinan, husband of Hazel. So we love taking people out to the cemetery because we'll stand on Charles' grave and tell this little story and then go, oh, here's Charles, you know. So even like in her death, she was still making a kind of a pointed comment. So, and I leave you with a couple other things. You know, again, this is just a quick image from 1917. This is a full-length portrait. I had to cut it into 3 pieces. And, of course, the only woman on the in the Congress at the time was Jeanette Rankin. We're the third most populous country in the world. Over 50% are women. Yet today in the House of Representatives, there are currently 362 men and 76 women. In the Senate, there are 83 men and 17 women. Almost 100 years after the passing of the amendment in 1920, men still outnumber women in Congress 4-1. And of course, Jeanette Rankin is the only woman who has ever served in Congress for Montana. So, I had this great button. I don't know where I have this, but the button basically of these three fearless leaders in the early days of the suffrage movement, it said, "Oh, I'm sorry you had to wait so long to vote." Remember how people would complain in Billings, you know, people had to wait like 45 minutes online at the Metro Park to vote, and people were like up in arms. And I love this button because, of course, it took them 42 years once the Susan B. Anthony amendment was written to actually get it passed. 42 years of efforts. And like what I find interesting in the whole movement is how many strategies were involved. Like I said, you're just seeing one small strategy with Hazel Hunkins and the National Women's Party, which was probably one of the more radical arms, but just one of so many different ways to try to accomplish the same goal. So I leave you with the founders of the idea. So, and I think that's all I have.